Morning, this is Kevin Olenek, Director of PERS. Before we begin the agenda, I want to go over a few technical items. The meeting is being recorded and the audio will be available on the PERS website later this week. Due to bandwidth concerns, board members and presenters will have their cameras off. A few technical items to note as well. As always, public testimony will be taken on action items at the chair's discretion, and it will be submitted to the PERS board email link 3 days in advance of the meeting. Public testimony was submitted within these timelines and is part of the posted board packet. We will not be monitoring the chat or raised hand features in this meeting. And additionally, the full board meeting packet is available either as a handout in your GoToWebinar control panel, and it's also available on the PERS website. With that, I will turn the meeting over to Chair Shenoy.
Thank you, Kevin. Good morning, everyone, on this fresh, early spring Monday. Welcome to the January 2022 Oregon PERS board meeting. I am Sadhana Shenoy, chair of the board, and I call this meeting to order. Could all the board members present please announce themselves?
This is Lawrence Fernstall.
Stephen Buckley.
Jordan Jaramillo.
John Scanlon.
Well, thank you, board members. So diving right into the agenda for today, first up is the approval of the December 2021 board meeting minutes. Any questions or comments on the minutes as presented? Okay, hearing none, do I hear a motion to approve the minutes?
Lawrence Frenchdale moves approval of the minutes.
Stephen Buckley, I second the motion.
Thank you. Board members, please state your name followed by an aye for approval or nay for denial. Sadhana Shenoy, aye.
Lawrence Fernstall, aye.
Stephen Buckley, aye.
Jordan Jaramillo, aye.
John Scanlon, aye.
Wonderful. Thank you all. December meeting minutes are approved. Next up, we have the director's report presented by Director Olenek.
Thank you, Chair Shenoy, Vice Chair Fernstall, board members. For the record, Kevin Olenek, director. For board members, just a quick reminder to please identify yourself when you're speaking, moving, or seconding a motion so that we can accurately reflect that in the minutes. Welcome to the January 31st, 2022 board meeting via GoToWebinar. We are continuing to meet virtually as a result of the agency's efforts to work through COVID-19 challenges while continuing as best possible to maintain operations. While we are actively working towards having staff coming back to the office so that we could reopen to the public on January 3rd, in late December, we were advised by the state that reopening was delayed indefinitely. Ultimately, whenever we reopen, the majority of staff will be working remotely while still ensuring that our ongoing business needs are met. We're also working through the logistics of whether board meetings will be held virtually, in person, or as a combination thereof, as we're in the process of updating our boardroom audiovisual technology. More to come on that front for the March board meeting, but at this time, I believe it will be held fully virtual. As always, an interesting agenda to work through this morning. Director's report is a summary of items the board should be aware of and aren't part of the board agenda materials. Forward-looking calendar, we've included future board meeting dates as well as audit committee dates are identified. One note, the OIC meeting noted on September 7th may be a joint meeting, but that's still to be confirmed. Please put it on your calendars as it covers the results of the OIC asset liability study and should be at least a must listen to event for the board. A2B, OPERF investment returns. December returns showed regular account earnings of positive 20.05%. Agenda C6, the 2021 preliminary earnings report, will go into more detail on this topic. Budget execution report, we're still in very good shape with a positive variance of about $1.9 million. A2D, Jason will present the annual report of the director's financial transactions that were reviewed at the December audit committee meeting. For administrative rulemaking, Stephanie will notice three rules, have first reading on one rule, and recommend adoption of two others. C1, Heather will provide a legislative preview and update. C2, Yvette will report out on her progress on implementing Senate Bill 1049. C3, Mary Michelle will provide an update on Senate Bill 1566. The report that she's presenting was submitted to the legislature as part of our statutory reporting requirements. C4, Sam will provide an update on reporting and funding overpayments to members as part of the data verification project. Following that, Jake will present a recommendation relating to the vendor who will conduct the equal to or better than actual testing. C6, Richard will present the 2021 preliminary earnings crediting and reserving updates. This report will also be submitted after this meeting to the legislature as part of our statutory reporting requirements. And this and the 1566 report will be presented to the General Government Ways and Means Subcommittee on February 15th. Last but certainly not least, our partners from Milliman will present an actuarial update reflecting on earnings through December 31st, 2021. If there's any questions, I'd be happy to take them now, Chair Shenoy.
Okay, thank you, Kevin. I thought that your report called The Year in Retrospect was a really was wonderful to read. It was succinct and yet a very comprehensive look at both the role of the PERS board as well as where PERS the system stands today. A lot of this information is generally not known as much to members and stakeholders, so I do want to highlight a few items from your report. First of all, Oregon's retirement system, as we all know, is a bit unusual in its setup. As you mentioned, three different entities are responsible for defining and executing its various components. I think this is a very important feature to understand about Oregon's retirement system. Thank you also for including information from NASRA showing the median rate of rates of return, as well as the funded status from our cohort of pension systems in North America. Typically, these reports are available to the board to see, and so it's nice to see that you're sharing some of these details with members and public at large. And lastly, the actuaries at Milliman are a huge asset to this board. Their financial modeling of the system out into the next few decades really helps this board to make decisions, ensuring that the system ultimately achieves full funding. So I think these are important facts, and I'm really glad you included them in your director's report. And as I said before, making this information available to members and stakeholders is important. I also want to note that Heather Case is sharing that responsibility with Kevin. She has published a nice article in the December 2021 Perspectives newsletter. Any comments on this topic from other board members? Okay. If not, then some other shout outs. PERS has launched this year an Employee of the Year Award. And on behalf of the board, I want to congratulate Matt Graves from FSD for winning this award. Also launched this year was the Manager of the Year Award. And congratulations to Brandon Armitas for being the winner this year. I think that concludes my comments on the director's report. There is section 2D, which needs to be presented, and I invite Jason Stanley to do so.
Thank you, Chair Shenoy, members of the board. This is Jason Stanley, Chief Compliance Audit and Risk Officer. I'd like to present item A2D, which is the annual requirement that the board acknowledge receipt of the report on the director's expenses for the fiscal year ended June 30th, 2021. These were presented in more detail during the December 3rd, 2021 audit committee meeting. And in accordance with policy, I'd just like the whole board to acknowledge receipt of that. Ask any questions if there are any. We didn't have any transactions that all transactions appear to be appropriate. There was nothing unusual to report. But if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer those. And if not, then I just need acknowledgement from the board. Thanks.
Any questions? Okay. If not, then on behalf of the board, I acknowledge the receipt of this report of the director's financial transactions. Thank you, Jason. Okay, moving on to section B of the agenda, I invite Stephanie Wan to present the administrative rulemaking.
Good morning, Chair Shenoy, members of the board. For the record, Stephanie Vaughn with PERS. We begin with item B1, which is notice of our rules regarding the Oregon Savings Growth Plan. We have a number of rules in this package, but this is just a cleanup. We haven't looked at these rules or haven't touched these rules in some time. So we went through and corrected some references to old or to investment options that don't exist anymore, updated processes to reflect electronic forms and submission options. We also updated the loan fee from $50 to $75. That was actually changed a few years ago with our contract with Voya. It just hasn't been reflected in rule. The details are all in the rules as far as the changes. We anticipate bringing these forward for adoption at the March board meeting. Are there any questions before I move on? All right. Item B2 is notice of our salary and contribution limit rules. These are rules that we update every year for to be in compliance with the Internal Revenue Service requirements as well as our statute. The annual salary limitation is indexed according to the Consumer Price Index, and for December 2021, for the prior 12 months, that CPI was 6.4%, which is quite steep. That is bringing our annual salary limitation up to $210,582. And normally we would use that same CPI to adjust the monthly annual salary threshold that determines the redirection of a portion of the members' monthly contributions into the employee pension stability account. And however, House Bill 2906, which passed in the 2021 session, reset that limit to $3,333 a month as of January 1, 2022. So that is being reset according to the legislature, and it will be indexed according to that CPI moving forward in future years. We've also updated the Social Security limits according to those federal limits as well. This is notice only, so no action is required, and we anticipate bringing these forward at the March board meeting. Item B3 is notice of our document submission rules. We are recommending repealing 459-001-0010. That rule was specific to filing papers with regard to appeals and contested cases. And the rule for receipt of documents, the 459-005-0210, has been amended to incorporate or account for any documents that we would receive. We also note that documents that are subject to service under court rules are not affected by this rule. So anything that requires service, petitions, complaints, that sort of thing, are still subject to court rules. However, if there's documentation that a member has regarding their appeal, and it does not contain personally identifiable information, we don't allow members to send us emails and such with attachments that have personally identifiable information, because email is not secure. But if it doesn't contain PII, personally identifiable information, those documents can be submitted through email or through fax, and that is what is reflected in the amendments we've made. This is notice only, so there's no action required, and we anticipate bringing these forward for adoption at the March board meeting. Item B4 is our first reading of the rules implementing Senate Bill 112, which was passed in the 2021 session. This was originally noticed in December, along with all of our other rules implementing the 2021 legislative changes. However, we received public comment specific to this rule from a member of the work group. We had put together a work group to work through the changes for these rules. That work group was comprised of member and employer representatives, and the request was to continue those discussions. So we are doing a first reading now, and we will be reconvening the work group for further discussions and consideration of a future of other changes to the rules. However, most of the individuals involved with that work group are people who are heavily involved with the legislative session. And as the legislative session, the short session, is starting tomorrow, we are anticipating it may be difficult to get all of those individuals together in a meeting in the month of February, or at least while session is in place. So we're doing a first reading today. We anticipate probably doing a second reading in March and adopting in May, just because we want to make sure that we have enough time to meet with everybody or get the work group meetings together. This is not something that is requiring immediate implementation, so we do have the luxury of time to work through these concerns with the members of the work group. So no action is required at this time. Again, we are anticipating adoption probably in May of this particular rule. Item B5 is the adoption of all of the rules implementing our 2021 legislation. This is incorporating the new required minimum distribution age, including or implementing the new provisions for the tax remedy certifications or the residency certifications for the purposes of receiving tax remedy. The withdrawal provisions for the OSG or the OPSERP, and clarification on the divorce provisions for spouses, and clarifications for charging employers for prior year earnings on late contributions. We received no public comment on the rules, and we've made no changes to these rules since notice, so we are seeking a motion to adopt the rules as presented.
Do I hear a motion to adopt the rules to implement the 2021 legislation as presented?
This is Stephen Buckley. I move that the board adopt the proposed administrative rules to implement the 2021 legislation as presented in the agenda packet.
Lawrence Fernstall seconds.
Thank you. All those in favor, please say aye. Sadhna Shenoy, aye.
Lawrence Fernstall, aye.
Stephen Buckley, aye.
John Scanlon, aye.
Jordan Jaramillo, aye.
Wonderful. Thank you all. So moved.
Thank you. And finally, item B6 is adoption of the benefit of the earnings crediting rule. This the amendments to this rule specify that there is not a cap. We've removed the cap from the amount of earnings that can be credited to the benefits in force reserve. Again, we had no public comment on this rule, and we've made no changes to the rule since notice, so we are seeking a motion to adopt the rule as presented.
Ms. Vaughn, this is Steve Buckley. If the cap is removed, how will the earnings crediting be determined? Will that be by a decision by the board each year?
Chair Shenoy, Board Member Buckley, yes, actually. And in the memo, in the agenda further down, as they are presenting the preliminary earnings crediting later in today's agenda, you'll see the line item specifically in that there's a chart in that memo, and the benefits in force reserve is on there. And I believe it's receiving or preliminarily set to receive approximately 20%.
And the proposed administrative rule is consistent with our past practice?
No, this is why we're changing, is because we have not been applying the cap. We have been crediting more than the assumed rate. The cap was set at whatever the assumed rate was, and we have traditionally been crediting more. There's no statutory requirement for the cap, and we could find no reason why the cap was in the rule when we performed research.
But our past practice has not been to limit the earnings crediting to the assumed rate.
Correct.
Thank you. I have no further questions.
Okay. Chair Shenoy, this is Lawrence Fernstall. I move adoption of the benefits in force earnings crediting rule as proposed.
This is Jordan Jaramillo. I second the motion as presented.
Thank you. All those in favor, please say aye. Sadhna Shenoy, aye.
Lawrence Fernstall, aye.
Stephen Buckley, aye.
Jordan Jaramillo, aye.
John Scanlon, aye.
So thank you, board members. So moved. And thank you, Stephanie.
Thank you.
Next up is agenda item C1, the legislative preview update by Heather Case.
Good morning, Chair Shenoy, members of the board. For the record, my name is Heather Case, Senior Policy Advisor at PERS. It's been a few meetings since I have come before the board, so I'm glad to be back talking about legislative items. The first, as always, my memo was up to date when I wrote it, but I will be providing more accurate updates now that we are closer to the 2022 session. As Stephanie Vaughn reported, the 2022 session begins tomorrow. So because it's a shorter session, it's only going to last until March 7th. It is beginning with a bang, and things are already starting. The agency is tracking bills of importance to state agencies as a whole, but we do have two bills so far that relate tangentially to PERS. I say tangentially because they do not modify any PERS statutes, for example, Chapter 238, but they are of interest to PERS. The first is House Bill 4115. This directs the Oregon Investment Council to publish a complete list annually of assets held in investment funds. This will include information that relates to the assessments of climate-related financial risk to the assets held in investment funds. So as you know, we don't handle the investment side of PERS, but this bill would include those assets in the OPERF. As the board knows, the PERS director is a non-voting member of the OIC, so this is just important for us to keep an eye on as a bill. The other bill is Senate Bill 1522. This is an education bill, and at first glance, it doesn't look like it would have anything to do with PERS. However, it is expected to receive an amendment. That amendment has not been published yet, but we do have word that the amendment will be related to the treatment of salary for PERS for charter schools only. As you'll recall, in Senate Bill 111 that passed in the 2021 session, the charter schools asked us for an amendment in that bill that would allow the salary fix that PERS implemented to be retroactive back to 2004. That amendment that came through on Senate Bill 111 was very wide and included all charter schools, and that was a mistake. It needed to be narrowed to not include all charter schools. So that's what this amendment to Senate Bill 1522 will do. So we are tracking that. Moving on to the part of my memo called reporting requirements, just an update. We have learned that our Senate Bill 1566 report and our preliminary earnings crediting report will be heard by the Joint Committee on Ways and Means Subcommittee on General Government on Tuesday, February 15th. So we are looking forward to presenting to that committee at that time. Moving on to our 2023 legislative concepts, just an update on the timeline. These proposed concepts will be introduced to stakeholders at a meeting on February 9th. So we will continue working with stakeholders throughout the month of February and incorporate their feedback as we move through the process. We are still on track to bring the concepts to the board for a final vote to be introduced as bills during the March 28th, 2022 board meeting. And with that, if I would love to invite questions from the board. All right, I'm not hearing any questions. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Heather, for that update. Let's see, item C2 is Senate Bill 1049 update. Yvette?
Good morning, Chair Shenoy, members of the board. For the record, Yvette Elledge Rhodes, Deputy Director. So since I last reviewed this board memo, there's been just a few updates. So we are still, the project health of all the projects remains the same as in the draft or in the board memo. However, our cross-project effort has now become a yellow status due to a delay in one of the work packages, work package 3, due to the Office 365 deployment. However, that deployment occurred last week, so we're evaluating this week if everything was deployed as needed, then that project will return back to green. So at the program level, we continue to review resource allocations due to the number of high priority projects outside of Senate Bill 1049 and the impact on resources. So we're going to be continuing to do that and planning. I think we're looking about 6 months ahead, so we should be able to avoid and mitigate any resource constraints. Our work after retirement project is looking great. We are conducting some closing activities. Our project closure quality gate is scheduled this week. And by the end of this month, or by the end of February, we will have all the closing documents completed. So that is a great effort and a successful project for the Senate Bill 1049 program. For member redirect, just a quick update on our current user acceptance testing for work package 4.3. We are in process, looking good. We have tested 70% of our test scripts and 75% of those have passed already. So we are on looking good for our ending date scheduled the deployment for March 24th. And then technical debt project, we had a little delay in our business functional testing for work package 1. That will now be completed by February 18th. We missed the January 19th date because of internal staff being out, but the lag in that testing should not be impacting our critical path. So we had built in enough time to avoid any impacts to the schedule. And then additionally for technical debt, we continue to review other items that we can include in this project. And that's the way this project is structured, where we will continue to evaluate future technical debt items that we can include in this project. For our IQMS activities, We are reviewing the final draft of the quarterly status and improvement report that we received. I just wanted to highlight that this was the lowest number of recommendations so far. We had 86 of them green and only 14% yellow, no reds in that report, meaning that we've really been able to address a lot of the risks and recommendations that Gartner has provided to us. And then this week we should be receiving our lessons learned document to review. As Heather noted, Kevin reported to the JLCIMT, the Joint Legislative Committee for Information Management Technology, last month, and we received no questions. It is indicative that everything is going smoothly. And our normal monthly January and February stakeholder meetings have been canceled due to the 2022 legislative session activities. Again, just, you know, I think it highlights that this program has been moving along smoothly. And then lastly, I just wanted to touch on our budget for this program. We are sitting at an $8 million variance. We do expect that a good portion of that variance will be used to fund the remaining work packages for member redirect and technical debt in this biennium. So I am available for any questions if you have any.
Thank you, Yvette, for the report. Director Olenek and Director Fernstall and I were discussing whether or not a lot of your staff has been released from the Senate Bill 1049 project since a bunch of them have closed. And I wonder if you have any comments about that.
Thank you, Chair Shenoy, members of the board. We are evaluating as projects close, whether there are specific resources, whether they be contractors or internal staff, then we do release them to go back to their primary work or release them from the project completely. So we do that resource review monthly. And the other item we're looking at is going forward to the 23-25 biennium. Reviewing our complete list of limited duration staff, the 35 that we have on staff right now, to see if they will no longer be needed. So we do have some of those that we've already identified will not be needed past the end of this biennium. So that is a routine task that we do to make sure that we have the correct resources. A lot of our subject matter experts are experts on more than one project in more than one area. So unfortunately, those have to remain on the project.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions from the board? Right, thank you, Yvette. The next agenda item is Senate Bill 1566, Reporting Requirements, Mary Michelle Sosny.
Good morning, Chair Shenoy, members of the board. For the record, my name is Mary Michelle Sosny, Actuarial Business Specialist at PERS. Senate Bill 1566 introduced the employer programs we currently associate with Senate Bill 1049, the School District's Unfunded Liability Fund, the Employer Incentive Fund, the Unfunded Actuarial Liability Resolution Program, and amortization options for side accounts of $10 million or more. The school district's unfunded liability fund received a $45 million transfer from interest on unclaimed property this month and is expected to receive a forecasted $74.9 million in estate tax proceeds in 2023. Despite these transfers, there will not be enough to provide a pool-wide side account by the end of the biennium. The Employer Incentive Fund currently has $7 million, and we expect at least an additional $12 million by the end of the biennium. Last year, Senate Bill 846 was passed and requires PERS to certify the amount required to match employer payments prior to receiving funds. This is a new requirement, and we are working on the best way to incorporate this change without negatively impacting employers. The Unfunded Actuarial Liability Resolution Program has completed its initial series of guides to help employers understand the fundamentals of rate development and how the documents and presentations available to them can assist with budgeting and forecasting. Additionally, the employer rate projection tool was updated this month with the current advisory rate, new assumed rate, and payroll growth assumptions. Lastly, the additional amortization options continue to be an option for employers, and another site account was established in 2021 with a six-year amortization. With that, I'm happy to answer any questions you have or provide any clarification needed. Otherwise, I thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mary Michelle. Hearing no questions from the board, we'll move on to the next item, C4, reporting and funding overpayments to members. Sam Paris and Amanda Marble.
Good morning, Chair Chinoy, members of the board. For the record, my name is Sam Paris, Chief Operations Officer. Today's presentation is the first time we are reporting to the board overpayments to members resulting from an error in a locked data verification. As stated in the memo, statute directs us to fund those overpayments since we are unable to collect overpayment from the member. The table provided shows 8 overpayments going back to the establishment of the data verification process in 2011. You will notice the majority of the errors are tied to complex rules and or limited system functionality, which we are planning to address through Orion modernization. We also continue to modify and review our quality assurance processes to both identify and resolve these. Moving forward, we will be reporting any new overpayments to the board on an annual or as needed basis to ensure that they are appropriately funded. As indicated in the memo, our recommendation is to pass a motion to approve the transfer of contingency reserve funds to fund these 8 overpayments as listed in the amount of $48,513.79. And I'd be happy to take any questions that the board may have.
So Sam, you mentioned that moving forward, this will be reported to the board on an annual basis if there are any overpayments, meaning that you will do the testing on a yearly basis.
Yes, thank you, Chair Chinoy, and members of the board. Once we identify if an error has been regrettably made, we report that and we keep a record of it, and then at the appropriate time, we would come back to the board to get approval to move those funds to the from the contingency reserve.
Okay. All right. Board members, any questions? If not, do I hear a motion to adopt this transfer?
This is Lawrence Fernstall. I move that we approve the recommended funding of overpayments by the transfer from contingency funds.
Stephen Buckley, I second the motion.
Thank you. All in favor, please say aye. Sadhna Chinoy, aye.
Lawrence Fernstall, aye.
Stephen Buckley, aye.
Jordan Jaramillo, aye.
John Scanlon, aye.
Wonderful. Thank you, board members. So moved. Thank you, Sam. Moving along, the next item, C5, is equal to or better than testing. Jake Winship.
Good morning. Thank you, Chair Chinoy, members of the board. For the record, my name is Jake Winship. I'm the actuarial manager at PERS. And as we have discussed at the last two board meetings, there is a requirement to determine whether police and fire plans outside of PERS provide benefits substantially equal to or better than their members would receive were they part of PERS. And in order to facilitate that, we submitted a request for quote to three employers. That process took place in the month of January with a response due date of January 26th. From those solicitations, we received a single response, and that is from Independent Actuaries Incorporated. Staff has reviewed the proposal. We believe that it fulfills the requirements of the determination, and therefore we recommend and ask that the board award the contract to perform the actuarial determination for equal to or better than testing to Independent Actuaries Incorporated. Are there any questions?
Mr. Winship, this is Steve Buckley. What agency is responsible for reviewing or drafting the proposed contract with Independent Actuaries? Is that PERS staff, Department of Justice, DAS?
It is PERS staff, and it has been reviewed by Department of Justice. So it is our responsibility. And there has been a relatively abbreviated time frame. I cannot speak to whether that the proposal has gone through that process as yet.
Okay, thank you.
Jake, this is Sadhana Shenoy. So these Independent Actuaries Inc., have we worked with them before in any capacity at all? Is Milliman familiar with these people? Given that only one organization has responded, I just want to make sure that we are getting somebody who can do the work comprehensively.
Of course, Chair Chinoy. And yes, it is my understanding that they have done previous work in support of PERS audit. Furthermore, I've spoken with Matt and Scott from Milliman. They are familiar with the firm. They had no objections to their ability to perform the work. Further, we have been provided an individual who would be the principal actuary and main contact. His name is Aaron Reardon. And based on his biography, I believe he has previous association with Milliman as well as Ernst & Young. And he will be doing the main work with review and supervision by the president of the company, Stephen Deese.
Okay, wonderful. Thank you, Jake.
Jake, this is Lawrence Fernstall. Just wondering if I could ask a quick question. I'm very supportive of the proposal. Do we have any sense why no one else bid?
I do not. I did have some contact initially with the three firms. I perceive that Summit Benefit and Actuarial Services, which is also a local firm there based in Eugene, I perceived hesitancy about being involved with a state program. Uh-huh. I had the sense that they had concerns about the associated liability. I'm frankly somewhat surprised that Bartell Associates, who are based in California, I believe San Mateo, and looking through, they've worked significantly with the various pension plans in California. I also had a positive response in terms of seeking to participate in the bid. So I'm uncertain why they did not respond. Conceivably, it could have been a timing issue.
Yes. Thank you, sir.
Yeah, that was a good question, Director Funstall. So if there are no other questions, then do I hear a motion?
This is Stephen Buckley. I'd make a motion that the equal to or better testing program be awarded to Independent Actuaries, Inc., provided PERS staff determines that the proposed fees and contract terms are commercially reasonable.
John Scanlon, I second.
Thank you. All board members in favor of this motion, please say aye. Sadhna Shenoy, aye.
Lawrence Fernstall, aye.
Stephen Buckley, and aye.
Rodan Jaramillo, aye.
John Scanlon, aye.
Wonderful. Thank you, board members. So moved. And thank you, Jake, for your presentation. See the next item, item C6, preliminary 2021 earnings crediting, and that will be presented by Richard Horsford.
Good morning, Chair Shenoy, members of the board. For the record, Richard Horsford, Chief Financial Officer at Oregon PERS. Today, I'll be presenting the 2021 earnings crediting, as noted in my memo. As we go through the memo, you'll note that many of the fund's earnings rates are dictated by rule or statute, as listed in the number of bullet points. Of particular interest this year, I'll draw your attention to the tables on both page 3 of my report and page 5. Those tables show two different scenarios. As we're used to, the Tier 1 accounts on both of them will be at the assumed rate of 7.2%. Many of the other accounts will range in the lower portion of a 20% return, with the exception of IAP accounts, which the IAP target date fund accounts are all invested in different target date funds with different investing strategies. So those range from about 11.5% to 18.26%, and with an average of 16.26%. The difference in the two tables that I had mentioned here particularly relates back to a difference in the contingency reserve. During this year, we completed a OPSERP IAP first wage cleanup project. This was a project that addressed some discrepancies with first wage, and it was actually approved by the board on November 18th of 2016 to embark on this cleanup project, at which time the board approved using contingency reserves of approximately $21.8 million to cover this discrepancy. As we've finally been able to clean this project up, the net amount needed for the cleanup was just shy of $18 million. So the one particular choice that lies in front of the board today is, as we've used that $18 million of contingency reserved, we're sitting at $32 million. And the choices, the board could choose to do nothing and leave the contingency at $32 million, or the board could choose through the earnings crediting process to replenish the contingency reserve. And the two tables that I referred to on pages 3 and 5 demonstrate the differences. And as you can see, for the most of the accounts, if we do not fund the contingency reserve, the bulk of the accounts in the middle will range from about 20.22% return to 20.47% return. Whereas if we do choose to fund the contingency reserve back to the $50 million, those accounts will in turn range from about 20.19% to 20.44% due to that money being redirected to the contingency reserve. Staff is recommending that the board replenish the contingency reserve back to the $50 million. With that, I will pause and see if there are any areas that the board would like to dig deeper into or clarifications I can provide.
So, Richard, this is Sadhana Shenoy. You mentioned that the first wage cleanup project, the time period seemed to be between 2004 and 2014. So I assume that is cleared up now, and after 2014, these inconsistencies have been taken care of?
That's correct. Those were errors that as the OPSERP program was kicking off, and some of the first wages were misinterpreted during that time. Since then, it's been cleaned up, so we don't expect any new problems to pile on with this challenge.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions from the board? Okay, hearing none, do I hear interest in a motion to adopt the motion that's recommended by staff?
This is Jordan Jaramillo. I move to adopt the motion as presented by staff.
This is Lawrence Fernstall. I second.
Thank you, board members. All those in favor, please say aye. Sadhana Shenoy, aye.
Lawrence Fernstall, aye.
Stephen Buckley, aye.
Jordan Jaramillo, aye.
John Scanlon, aye.
Thank you, board members. So moved. And thank you, Richard, for that presentation.
All right. Thank you.
That brings us to the last item on today's agenda, item C7. That's from the Milliman team. It's the update reflecting on earnings through December 31st, 2021.
Thank you, Chair Shenoy. This is Scott Preperna with Milliman. Can you confirm that you can see my screen? I think I should be sharing now.
Yes.
Okay, great.
Thank you.
Thanks. All right, so I'm going to start off with a brief presentation. I'm joined by my colleague Matt Larrabee as well, and if there are any questions, we're happy to respond to them. But this will be undoubtedly our shortest presentation of 2022 for the board. I'm sure there's about four slides here. So just a little bit of context, as the board will remember, sort of recent meetings and recent items that we've covered in October. We presented the system-wide results of the 12/31/2020 actuarial valuation, which really dealt with advisory valuation results. So results that would go into effect in 2023-25 if we were going to be setting them at that time. But of course, it'll actually be determined by the rate setting valuation reflecting results at the end of 2021. So the valuation in October that we discussed was the first one that reflected updated assumptions from the experience study, including a 6.9% assumed rate and modifications to the rate collar that the board and worked through over the last 12 or 18 months before that. In December, we provided advisory specific results for employers' contribution rates, and spent a lot of time talking about the long-term financial modeling projections. At that time, we were working from OPERF results through the end of September, which were about a 15.4% return there. We discussed contribution rates, funded status, and what that looked like over a 20-year period. Today is a much more narrow focused update reflecting the strong year-end 2021 returns, and really just trying to look at what our first guess is that the rate setting valuation that we'll publish later this year might look like based on the strong 2021 returns of over 20% published by OPERF. Of course, the actual valuation will reflect new census data and the gains and losses that may have occurred during the 2021 year for the population, which we don't have yet. We'll get that this spring and work through the process. And then kind of looking ahead in the July board meeting, we'll be able to present to the board the actual valuation results based on that new census data. And then in September of 2022 is when the actual 2023 to 25 contribution rates will go to the board for adoption. So it's sort of context here. And then slide two, this is our preliminary estimate of what the year-end 2021 funded status and UAL, unfunded accrued liability, picture sort of looks like given the good 20% returns for the actual 2021 investment year. And so shown there in sort of the center of the page in the middle boxes, excluding side accounts, the UAL is now below $20 billion, so 19.7 there, and funded status up to 80%. If you include side accounts in this comparison, then the UAL is $14.4 billion and funded status at 85%. So again, as I mentioned, this is a preliminary estimate. It reflects really last year's census data rolled forward. So this will vary in the final accounting when we come back to it in a few months, but this is sort of a good marker for now to know what the good investment returns the last year did. This will get updated both for census, but new site accounts. And really for context here, when we were discussing back in October, the year-end 2020 results, and from that advisory evaluation, the UAL was at $28 billion and funded status, excluding site accounts, was 71%. So clearly really strong asset year. Makes significant improvement in these results just even over a one-year time frame.
Scott, this is Steve Buckley, and you may have said this. Do the numbers on slide two assume the 6.9% assumed rate of return, or are they still using the 7.2% assumed rate of return?
They are at the 6.9% assumed rate for the calculation of the liabilities. So just as the advisory 12/31/2020 valuation reflected that new lower assumed rate, and that pushed up the accrued liability and increased the UAL at that time, as we discussed back in October. But so that that lower assumed rate had pushed the UAL up to $28 billion, but then the really strong asset returns over the last year actually shrunk it down to the 19.7 excluding side accounts shown here.
Thanks very much.
You're welcome.
This is Sadhana Shenoy. I know that these numbers are so incredibly dependent on investment returns, but may I just say that this looks really good, and I am delighted to see these numbers. Of course, knowing fully well that they've changed as of today, but looks good. Thank you.
Right. Okay. So moving from sort of funded status to contribution rates, to get an idea of this, this is the historical total pension contribution rate sort of for the system as a whole, system average, that the board will be familiar with from prior meetings. I'm going to focus on the right side of this graph for today, really just to say what the last sort of solid rates out here in 21 to 23, those are the rates that are in effect right now. And then these dotted lines that are shown to the right are, again, a preliminary estimate of what the 23 to 25 biennium rates might look like based on today's estimate. And so this really translates that good improvement seen from the 2021 calendar year asset returns into what that might mean on a rate perspective. For context, when we talked about this back in October and we're reflecting on results really through the end of 2020, we had expected both the gray and the light blue line towards the top here, the uncolored and colored total base rate, to make about a 3% step up to the next biennium. So that's what at the end of 2020, the advisory valuation would have suggested given the lower assumed rate. So the rate has dropped down to 6.9, and these lines had been stepping up about 3% at that time. Now that we've actually are incorporating the asset gain from the last year, what you'll see is the uncolored total rate, the gray line, is actually decreasing. And the colored total base rate the light blue line is stepping up in a more modest way than what we would have discussed in October. And the reason that the collared rate is now above the uncollared rate and the reason those moved in different directions is due to the changes made to the rate collar in the last experience study, where the board decided to introduce decreased restrictions such that asset gains such as this would first really hold the UAL rate steady rather than let the UAL rate drop to reflect those gains. It would hold the UAL rate steady until a certain funded status threshold around 90% had been met, so that those gains really first go towards filling in the shortfall before it reduces the UAL contribution rate. So that's why we're seeing in this projection the collared total rate still bump up a little bit, because we are reflecting the decrease in the assumed rate that bumps up the cost of the normal cost of the ongoing accrued benefits, but we're holding the UAL rate steady and sort of not counting the gains to lower that rate, if you will, for the first biennium. So that's the reason for the change there. And to the point you alluded to, Chair Shenoy, on the prior slide, the fact that some of the gains from 2021 equity markets had surrendered in January of this year, if that were to hold, hopefully it'll bounce back and we'll still have a positive return year. But if that were to hold, one of the virtues of the decreased restrictions is that the UAL rates are not yet really reflecting all the gains from last year. They're just holding steady. And so if this year were to, you know, revert somewhat to something disappointing, then we don't have the rates marking down just because 12/31/2021 ended up being a high point of the markets, for example.
This is John Scanlon. What I'm looking at here, I remember at a previous meeting we kind of talked about the collar having a ratchet. Is that what you're describing there?
Exactly. So these contribution rates have the two parts. They have the normal cost and the UAL. And the UAL is the part that we're not letting that, even though on the face of it, the 20% returns from last year would have said that the UAL rate on sort of just the pure actuarial basis could decrease somewhat. And that's what you're seeing here in the kind of the gray line. The rate collar policy is saying, we're not going to let that decrease yet. We're going to hold it steady because we're not yet to a sufficient funded status with the policy that we want to let that gain come through and lower the rate. Instead, we're going to take that gain and just let it improve the funded status, but not kind of knock down the contribution rate for it yet.
And Scott, John Scanlon, I'm sorry. Yeah. Remind me again, is 90% the magic number?
90% is sort of the full decrease allowed. We, as we discussed with the board, it phases in over essentially 88, 89, 90% so that it's not just an abrupt cliff. But yeah, it's 90% is when the full decrease would be allowed on the collar total rate, the full 3% decrease for most of the pools or 4% for independent.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Scott, this is Sadhana Shenoy. Can you talk about the contribution of member redirect offset to the total rates?
Yes, that's a great segue to the next slide, actually, which turns this. So slide 3 was talking about total rates, and then those total rates are paid both by member redirect and employer rates. And then when we get from the base to the net employer rate, also side account offset. So slide 4 turns this into, you know, a little more detailed numeric picture of this, but same thing that we really saw in the prior slide. So these were the total base uncollared rate and collared rate that we saw in the prior slide for these two, 21 to 23 and the estimated 23 to 25 biennium. So again, same picture here, just in numbers rather than the graphical form, where you see the uncollared total rate, the top row, decrease around 2% of payroll here, given the good investment returns. The collar total base rate actually increase 0.8% of pay. And then The member redirect offset is shown on that next line to show how much is really offset by the contributions that go to EPSA. So around 1.2% in the current biennium, we're estimating 1.1% in the coming biennium. That shifts over time just as the population shifts from Tier 1, Tier 2 to OFSERP, because Tier 1, Tier 2 has a bigger member redirect portion. So that kind of works it out down to what the employer rate is rather than the total rate here. So Chair Shinoy, I'll pause there for, did you have a specific question related to the redirect, or does that answer it?
No, I think that I mean, it's a small enough number that it's not worth showing on the previous graph.
And so it's one where it wouldn't be too visually apparent on the...
Exactly. Thank you, Scott.
Yep. The final point that I think is worth making here is that while the base employer rate, for example, the second from the bottom here, while that shows an increase, the net employer rate is holding steady. And that's really a combination of the increase in the base rate, but then a further offset on the system average level for site account, projected here for site account offsets, since site accounts get actual investment return as well, and 2021 was a good investment year, then those site account offsets are projected to grow from biennium to biennium for that reason. And very important, I mean, I've already noted that this is all preliminary and the results will change when we get the final census results and get to the actual final valuation. It's also really important to note that for any individual employer, they do not look like the system average necessarily. Their mileage may vary depending on their pooling situation and their own funded status and experience. So, this is really helpful for sort of the overall system average trend to know where it's moving, but individual employers will differ from this. Pause there for any other questions. This is really the last slide that we had prepared. Any other questions, or Matt, if you want to add anything else to the comments.
Chair Shinoy, this is Lawrence Fernstall. Just to make a comment that's shown both on this table and the previous graph, over time, over a long period of time, the uncollared and collared rate should sort of even out. But for a long time, we've had collared rates that were below the uncollared rates, but now that's reversed. Seeing the dotted gray line going below the dotted light blue line. And I think that's, to your point about the funded status, that's a good sign that we've reached this point on the rate side as well.
Yes, Director Fernstall, that's, I know we have a long ways to go, but it just goes to show that one good year gives us, gives us a little bit of respite.
That's right.
Any other questions? Matt, did you have a comment?
Chair Shinoy, thank you. I think I'd like to echo some of the comments made by you and Board Member Fernstall and observations from Board Member Scanlon. I think we're really happy. Not that, emotion is part of, any sort of emotional intelligence is part of being an actuary, but, I think we're very happy with how the rate collar, the revised rate collar structure is performing for this first biennium. We had a very good 2021, and what is our rate response to that? Well, the rate response to that is, rather than trying to decrease rates in response to a good 2021, instead, effectively, we're keeping that as a bit of a rainy day fund. And if things go forward in the future around 6.9% return, all it will simply do is it will shorten our effective amortization period. So I think we are, this chart tells a nice story, and we're off to a good start in terms of the structure that the board adopted at last July's meeting after a pretty extensive review cycle.
Yes, agreed. Any other comments from the board? Yep. Hearing none, thank you, Matt and Scott, for your presentation. As you mentioned, it was one of the shorter presentations, and that's going to make for a short board meeting for us as well. This concludes the agenda items we had for today. Anything else from the board or from Kevin?
Chair Shinoy, nothing further from staff today.
Right. So then the next board meeting will be held on Monday, March 28th. It will still be online. Following that board meeting, there will be an audit meeting as well. So once again, I'm going to just pause to see if there's anything else from the board. Hearing nothing, I thank you all for your participation in today's meeting and see you all in March. This meeting is adjourned.